Accessibility Craft Podcast, where we explore the art of creating accessible websites while trying out interesting craft beverages. This podcast is brought to you by the team at Equalize Digital, a WordPress accessibility company and the proud creators of the Accessibility Checker plugin. And now, on to the show.
I am very excited to introduce our speakers today. We have two great speakers. I first got introduced to Dacey Nolan because I heard her on the Accessibility Rules podcast, and I reached out and I asked her if she would be interested in speaking for us, and she so generously agreed to come on and brought Alex as well. Dacey is a self-taught front-end software engineer. She is a Women in Tech mentor and is passionate about making the web accessible for all. And Alex is a product designer that specializes in design systems. Before transitioning into design, he worked in support and quality assurance. I'm going to remove my spotlight and let them take over, and I'll also stop sharing my screen. If you have any questions while they're talking, please put those into the Q&A if you can. Sometimes they get a little buried in the chat, and then we will address them towards the end of the talk. So welcome, Alex and Dacey, and we're so excited to have you here.
Thank you so much, Amber. We're very excited. So I'm going to briefly introduce myself, and then Alex will introduce himself. But my name is Dacey Nolan. So as we heard, I'm a front-end engineer on our design system squad at Trainual. So my background is with JavaScript and React. However, the things that we're going to talk about today can be applied to any language and stack. I am a self-taught engineer with a passion for web accessibility. So a little bit more about me. I do have a disability. We'll talk about that a little bit later. I'm also working on getting my certification as a web accessibility specialist. So I'm still learning, but that is something that I'm striving for. Let's see. I used to work with students with cognitive, auditory, and visual impairment, and I do know a little bit of American Sign Language, also referred to as ASL. So a long-term goal, I'm trying to be more fluent in ASL. Just so I can share with y'all today, I'm going to introduce myself in sign language, but note that I'm not good enough to sign the whole talk. So my name is Stacy. So I'll go ahead and hand it over to Alex.
Thank you, Dacey. So as I was discussed a little bit earlier, I'm a design systems designer at Trainual. I'm Dacey's partner in crime. I'm from Providence, Rhode Island. And yeah, just getting into the software industry, I was in support and QA and slowly moved over to design. And once I moved into design systems, I kind of got hit in the face by inclusive design. And kind of learning and being taught inclusive design, and a lot of people in the industry saying you can't have things be pretty and accessible, just really aggravated me. So I think that's kind of been the fuel of the fire for me. So definitely a lot more humble beginnings than Dacey. Don't have as much of a resume, but I know that's a lot of people in this talk. And I think the biggest thing is just to continue to learn about the subject. Dacey, do you want to take it away with your talk, just to begin to talk about epilepsy.
Yes. Yeah. So I always ask people, like, do y'all remember MySpace? But because I can't see all the participants, I'm hope that like some of y'all do remember that. So if you're not familiar with it, it was a social media tool, but kind of before Facebook and Twitter. And so kind of like, I guess the claim to fame is you could have your top friends list. You could have music playing whenever you logged on, and you could customize the background. That's where I fell in love with the CSS, is trying to go in and plug in different like hex codes to see how that looked. So I think somebody asked what it was. It's MySpace. So it was right after Xanga, right before Facebook. So one of my friends reached out to me when I was 16 and said, hey, I had just made a whole bunch of updates on my MySpace profile. Do you mind going and taking a look? And so I got reached out a lot from friends because I, you know, was already introduced to like working with like that CSS. So as a good friend, I said, sure, I'll go ahead and take a look at your MySpace profile. So immediately just went to the computer, logged in, went to her profile page. The next thing I remember, I was waking up in the hospital bed. I had just had my first seizure. So what my friend had added to her background was a animation of like a strobe light. And so she really thought that it would stand out and so many more people would, you know, visit her site and she would have more traction. But that animation is what had gave me my first seizure. And a week later, I was playing a video game with my brother and had my second seizure, and I was diagnosed with epilepsy. And so I've had epilepsy since I was 16. I'm almost 30, so almost 15 years. And so there's a lot of things that I've learned over the years. And really, because of my background and not being able to interact with websites and video games like a lot of my peers, I decided to go into web accessibility. And so it was really hard being a 16-year-old and not being able to use social media and then hearing your friends talk about it at school. I felt deflated. I didn't feel normal. And that's really why I went into web accessibility. So let's go ahead and talk about what seizures are. So a seizure is an abnormal electrical impulse in the brain that interrupts the normal connection between nerve cells and the brain. So people tend to say it's kind of like an electrical storm inside your brain. So things are misfiring. And so because of that, a person can experience some involuntary movements. They might even lose consciousness. And so it's really going to interfere with a person's ability to process information as well. Now, seizures can be brought up by many triggers. So some of those could be, you know, alcohol consumption, head injuries, stress, lack of sleep. When I was going through college, alcohol, stress, and lack of sleep, those were the big kickers for me. And I would have like 8 a day. And then there's one called that seizures can be triggered by light. Now this is called photosensitive. And so this is when content flickers, flashes, and blinks. This can trigger a photosensitive seizure. So things like natural light, if light hits the snow when it's falling, it could cause someone to have a photosensitive seizure. One of the most well-documented cases of flashing light seizures was from a Pokemon episode in 1997. I'm really big into Pokemon. I did see this episode way after the fact. I don't recommend y'all YouTubing it if you do have a history of seizures because it is pretty bad. But this episode had a scene with Pikachu, who was the lightning Pokemon. There was a battle scene. That scene sent 685 children to the hospital when they experienced seizures as a result of this intense flashing light scene. So not every seizure is going to look the same. So you might have heard of the infamous type called grand mal. We also refer to it as tonic-clonic. These types of seizures are when the person is going to lose consciousness and they're going to have rapid body movements. So you might have even seen them like Grey's Anatomy episode 1. They have a person who has lost consciousness and they're seizing up. It's not as floppy like a fish that we tend to see on TV. It's more like a steady jerk. So when a person wakes up, they're going to feel very sore. They might have a whole lot of bruises on them, and they're going to be very disoriented. Some other types of seizures, they used to be called absence seizures. I don't remember what they've got renamed to, but that's going to look like a person's just daydreaming. They look like they're just zoned off in space, and a lot of times people will get in trouble for daydreaming, but they could be having a seizure. Some others are going to look like maybe a spasm. When I do my makeup in the morning, sometimes my arm flies up in the air. And that's just because of this electrical impulse in my brain that's misfiring, so a seizure. So what is epilepsy then? Epilepsy is a seizure disorder. So typically someone is diagnosed if they have recurring unprovoked seizures. So let's take a look at some barriers that somebody with epilepsy might face. So as I mentioned, I wasn't able to be around a computer because of the constant flashing lights, as well as, you know, play certain video games. Now it's really good. Video games have a warning whenever you go online. I have been seizure free for about 10 years. So I am able now to like interact with the computer and video games, but I've been playing a Star Wars Lego game recently. And of course there's all these warnings, right? You know, that it could trigger a seizure. Some of the other things is, again, like the websites. Websites, you know, pretty much are accessible as far as like for people with epilepsy. However, it's the developers or the designers that decide that they want to add a flashing light that makes it not accessible for someone with epilepsy. So some other, you know, flashing lights can also have make somebody have a migraine, maybe nausea, vomiting. And so it's definitely not a good feeling for your users to have when they visit your site. Then they're going to associate those bad feelings with your site. So it's not good. So some advice for, you know, creating websites for people that might have a seizure disorder is try to avoid creating videos and animations with intense flashing lights. But something I see a lot on Instagram right now is because we're trying to grab people's attention with Reels and then TikTok, and they're using constant flashing lights, and I immediately start feeling very ill. So that's something not just for the developers, but also content creators, to make sure that they are not using those flashing lights to try to grab someone's attention. So we should really avoid flashes that are more frequent than 3 times per second, because anything that's quicker is going to potentially cause that photosensitive seizure. Now, there's a lot of other triggers, such as music for some people, things like that, but really just talking about the photosensitive here and like how light can play. You definitely take a look at what colors are being used, red with, you know, white, and depending on the patterns, if someone's like moving their head, it really does cause this like weird behavior to make it look like there is a flashing light. That's pretty much, you know, my talk about epilepsy. I've seen a lot of questions coming through the chat. So we'll go ahead and open the floor for questions.
Yeah, I wanted to start by asking you, do you feel like the web content accessibility guideline about, not more than 3 flashes per second, is that sufficient? Or do you think that it should actually be a higher or like a lower number?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I feel like I talked about this on the little podcast too. So whenever they're testing for a seizure, it's called an EEG, unlike a EKG, which is your heart, your EEG, they're going to put these like electrodes all over your head. And what they're going to do is they're going to do a series of different tests to see when you're going to have a seizure. And the first one is they're going to test if you're photosensitive. And so they're going to look at your brainwave, and they actually show light slower than 3 seconds. And people have had seizures. Whenever I was first diagnosed, that was something that right when they turned that light on, I immediately started having the brainwaves that showed I was having a seizure. So that's a good question. I would say yes, it needs to be way slower than the 3 seconds. I feel like this is probably just a good meeting point. I don't know kind of the background of why they chose that number, but just from my experience, I feel like that it should be a lot longer or like not used, you know, a flashing light at all. But yeah, I'd be curious to know like why they chose that number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't really know the background on that either as well. Caroline was asking, do you know how you can check if your animation flashes more than 3 times per second? Is there an easy way to test that for the general public?
So there is a tool, I should have looked this up, to test websites for flashing lights. I'm going to try to look it up really quick, really quickly and see if I can find it. But there is a tool out there that it'll scan, just like a lot of the automated accessibility tooling. And so I will try to find it and let y'all know.
Okay. Yeah, and I think that sort of covers the second question, which someone else had asked about if there was a tool. I know one thing that we've done, so if we're creating a GIF, for example, in Photoshop, you can sort of see how long your GIF is and where the changes of your different layers are when it's making more layers. And those aren't really lights per se, but that it's like changing or flashing of different things, certainly. And so that's something we can kind of look at the timeline just in Photoshop when we're creating the GIF and be like, are we having more than 3 changes per second? And if so, then probably the layers need to be stretched out so that the timeline is just longer. Let's see. I think Caroline was asking if that tool would work on social media too. And I don't know if you know if it works on a social media site or just on websites.
I don't. I haven't used the tool personally. But as far as like when I'm going through content, it is hard. Like I don't know of a good way for me to be able to scroll and not really see those flashing lights. If y'all do know, I've shared my LinkedIn, please let me know, because even though I have been seizure free for a couple of years, I still get really, really bad migraines because of these flashing lights. Depending on like, if I know the content creator, I'll reach out and just say, hey, you know, I probably would change this, you know, I give advice out of love and not really, you know, trying to like, I guess, attack them because people don't know what they don't know. Right. So, but yes, if y'all do know of a tool that can help me determine if there is going to be a flashing light, I would definitely would want to know. So, yeah.
Do you know, and I don't know if you know this, if you turn on prefers reduced motion in your on your computer operating system, does that stop some of those things if they're coded appropriately?
Yes, I have heard. Yeah, you never want to override the system preferences. But yeah, I've heard like that does work. I haven't done it on my phone, so I should probably do that.
Jean was asking, you said something about the color white and head movement. Could you go back to that and explain a little more?
Yeah, so it's really depending on like some of the color contrast, such as like white and black with a zigzagging pattern. And you kind of like, you know, if you're like looking, I mean, people don't really shake their head like this while they're on, looking at it. But however, some of those patterns, especially if you're scrolling, depending on where the pattern is oriented, that can do kind of like a strobing effect almost. I know a lot of this has been previous, like we've had a lot of advancements with our screens for like computers and stuff. So some of this could have been a lot longer, but yeah, definitely the use of patterns and colors with those patterns, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so like stripes or checkers almost that kind of stuff can really cause weird effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you know, there was a follow-up question about stickers on Instagram stories. Can those cause problems?
I don't know what that is. I'm sorry. I try not to get on social media a lot. If somebody could explain the sticker.
Yeah, so Instagram stories, you can take a video or a picture and then you can edit it and they have stickers, which sometimes they're animated. So I think they're I'm pretty sure it's just like a GIF the animation that it sticks onto it, right?
Yeah, I would say
would that be the same scenario?
Yeah, I would say any kind of flashing. It doesn't have to be super big to cause a problem. It could be like something very, very small. Like I said, things that you don't realize, like the most interesting for me is snow falling and your headlights hit it just right, definitely can cause a seizure. Even just natural light, if depending on how it's coming into the house, because it's not just flashing lights, it's, you know, just a mix of light in general.
Okay. Let's see. Alice is wondering, are there warnings on social media like there are on video games?
I have not seen any warnings on social media. I'm sure whenever I signed up, it's probably in the terms of use somewhere. This is where I've heard that the social media, because it's the person that's creating the content, that let's say it's Facebook, for an example, like I don't think Facebook's going to get in trouble if I decide to put a flashing light for my content. This is where it's, I think, you know, the user, whoever's creating the content, but I've not seen where content creators are, adding any kind of disclaimer of like, hey, my reel or my stories, you know, has flashing lights. I haven't seen that, but I'm probably sure it's probably listed in like terms of service of, you know, there might be flashing lights, especially, like I said, with so many content creators trying to grab your attention, and that's what they use a lot.
This episode of Accessibility Craft is sponsored by Equalize Digital Accessibility Checker, the WordPress plugin that helps you find accessibility problems before you hit publish. Thousands of businesses, nonprofits, universities, and government agencies around the world trust Accessibility Checker to help their teams find, fix, and prevent accessibility problems on an ongoing basis. New to accessibility? Equalize Digital Accessibility Checker is here to teach you every step of the way. Whether you're a content creator or a developer, our detailed documentation guides you through fixing accessibility issues. Never lose track of accessibility again with real-time scans each time you save, powerful reports inside the WordPress dashboard, and a front-end view to help you track down hard-to-find issues. Scan unlimited posts and pages with Accessibility Checker free. Upgrade to Accessibility Checker Pro to scan your website in bulk, whether it has 10 pages or 10,000. Download Accessibility Checker today at equalizedigital.com/accessibility-checker. Use coupon code ACCESSIBILITYCRAFT to save 10% on any plan.
Oh, so Carolyn followed up and she's actually wondering if you use, if you can use Instagram stories, but I think you said you don't really follow Instagram.
I rarely get on it because of the just not knowing. So I'd rather just like not use it. And this is why, you know, it's so important, like content creators. And then whenever thinking about like websites and front end engineering, you never want somebody to not be on your site because they're having a bad experience or they're not having the same experience as everyone. So I'm having to kind of take myself away from, you know, TikTok and Instagram and Snapchat just because there's that level of fear of like, I don't know what's going to happen if I access this and it's not accessible. And that's definitely not good because, you know, I love taking pictures and stuff. And I feel like, you know, I would be a good user. But yeah, that's something that, yeah, I don't get on it as much as I think a lot of people because of that fear.
Mm-hmm. What do you think those of us that are on those social platforms can do in order to bring more awareness to this to make for content creators, right? I'm sure like the platform itself knows, right? But what can be done for to encourage more content creators to realize?
Yeah, I definitely think it's, you know, it starts with people with epilepsy or that have had a seizure to, you know, kind of speak up and advocate. And then of course, then it'll kind of do like a domino effect of like more and more people are talking about it. But I would just say like, if you're on this call and you have a friend that's creating content, or maybe you know an influencer and you've seen those types of like content in the past, like definitely reach out with them with love and just say, hey, I just wanted to let you know, you might be able to reach more people if you actually take this out, or maybe starting it with a disclaimer, you know, something like just coming out, you know, informative and not like an attackful way. But even if you're creating content, kind of think about those things. Of, you know, how can I grab their attention without using a lot of like flashing effects?
Yeah, I think that's something that we kind of also like, one of the things I've been trying to do a little more is when someone shares a video or without captions, you know, maybe saying, hey, it'd be great if you could put captions on this, or an image, you know, without an alternative text or description, like saying, hey, use this feature. So let's see. So a couple of people shared Trace's tool in for photosensitive epilepsy analysis tool. Pete, is that the one you were thinking of?
It is that one. Thank you so much. I was like, I can't, I'm not a good multitasker. So even though I had my search engine up on the left side, yes, I have not used that tool a whole lot. I experimented with it briefly when I talked on the Accessibility Rules podcast. So very briefly. So I don't know how user-friendly it is and how accurate it is, but that was one that kept popping up in my research.
Okay, great. I think we have two more questions and we'll probably pause on questions and let you guys do your next thing, and then we'll sort back to more questions. So Andy had asked, are zigzag stripe checkerboard patterns always dangerous, or is it the combination of patterns and high contrast colors?
I would say it's the combination of, the colors. Let me see if I can find where this was documented. I want to say it's probably Mozilla had written a little thing about it, or WebAIM had like an article about it, but they did say it was the combination of colors with a pattern.
Okay, awesome. So maybe you'll find that and stick that in the chat for us. And then the last question before we move on, are there social media platforms that you do find to be accessible or that you're not worried about going on?
Yeah, definitely Twitter. Because a lot, I haven't seen a lot of people post a lot of GIFs. And so, especially the people that I follow, they don't really use a whole lot of GIFs. And the ones that they use don't affect me. So, but yeah, that's really what I use. And then LinkedIn too. Like, I don't have a whole lot of videos. Another thing that you can think about is if you're going to use a GIF or any kind of like video on your website, maybe allow the user to pause and then play. So don't play it right when the page loads. Allow the user to either play or even have the ability to pause that. That's one's huge. And that's the stuff that I try to look for is like, am I able to pause this? Or is it just stuck on my screen constantly, like repeating itself? So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if it's a setting that I turned on and I just don't remember it, but at least for me on Twitter, GIFs don't autoplay. Like they have a picture and it says like GIF on them and I have to click on it if I want it to play, which mostly I never do. So yeah, I feel like that's helpful. All right. Well, I'm going to pull Alex back up here and take myself off.
Cool. So thank you, Daisy, for that. Super inspiring, insightful, powerful. I finally, I think, learned not to tear up during that talk. So I think this was the first time on that, but thank you again. And we'll just kind of move it over to design systems and how they can be accessible too. I think Daisy and I both agree on this in terms of like working in design systems is a very powerful position to work on accessibility. So we're totally psyched about that. And we'll just kind of go into design systems a little bit more. So I'll start off with just kind of defining what a design system is. If people are unaware, go over a little bit about Trainual just very briefly and kind of the tools that we use and like the maturity of our design system. And then we'll really dive into like, you know, what we're doing on a day-to-day basis to make sure our product's more accessible. So design systems, I'm going to steal kind of a definition from Brad Frost and Nielsen Norman and kind of make my epic design system definition. But how I would define it is it's a systems of systems intended to help your company consistently manage design at scale or manage your product at scale. So the key there is like system of systems. It's not one system. You're not going to just get like a component library in Figma and call that your design system. And on the other side, you're not going to just have like storybook with all your dev components or wherever you hold your dev components and call that your design system. It really is everything and all of the documentation aggregated together to make up how you make your product. So this includes, again, like components themselves, but also like patterns inside of your application. You know, how do you create an object? How do you delete an object? The writing, your voice and tone. So, you know, do you use sentence case? Do you use, you know, all caps for your buttons? And, you know, what's the tone? Do you keep your messages short, long, that kind of thing? And then also just all the documentation that comes with that. So like, even if you have documentation on how to document your stuff, you know, that is part of your design system. Like things that are inside Slack, that's your design system. It might be informal, but that's part of your design system. So I think kind of opening that like design systems up to like the entire like breadth of what it is, I think is very powerful because I think you can add accessibility in all of those things. At Trainual, so our company that Daisy and I work at, in a very short sentence, it's like a documentation, learning and training platform, kind of similar to Notion, but has more like accountability and stuff like that. So what I usually define design systems as at Trainual is I just say it's a Trainual on how Trainual makes Trainual. So that's kind of a lot of Trainuals, but the idea is it's like a documentation or what we call a Trainual documentation on how Trainual the company makes Trainual the product. So it's very loose in terms of the definition, but that allows people to understand, like, you know, a design system makes up a lot more than what people might think, you know, in the beginning. So for further background, I'll kind of discuss, like, again, the tools that we use at Trainual, and then also like the maturity of our design system. So the tools that we use at Trainual, start off with Figma. I'm a designer, so I use Figma a lot. Storybook is where we host our component library on the dev side. And then we have Zero Height, which is a really good software that can hold kind of like your style guide, what people deem as your style guide, which is a big component of your design system, where you can host that. And it can also take, you know, snippets from Storybook and Figma. So using kind of Zero Height, Storybook, and Figma has been like awesome for us. I think it's saved hundreds of hours. So those three things are our big ones. I know we use Chromatic for testing, and we're going to start to be using that more and more. And then we use Trainual, again, our product. We make Trainual content on how to use Figma, how to use Storybook, how to document things in Zero Height, and you know, more of like the how in terms of like the what that goes inside, you know, Zero Height. So the maturity, Daisy and I have been working at Trainual for a little bit less than a year. I would kind of deem our design system to be in like the acknowledgement phase. I kind of consider that to be like, you know, between like 2 and 3 phase of like a phase 5 approach, where phase 5 would be something like an IBM design system or something like that. So I'd still say that we're, you know, in the infancy stage in some aspects. And I say acknowledgement because our company is aware about it, and, you know, we've both been hired. So those are like huge hurdles to go over, and they acknowledge the importance of it. And why it can be, you know, can really ramp up our development process. I'd still say that how much people follow the design system is still up in the air. And that's something that, you know, Daisy and I continue to work on day in and day out to like get more people to follow the design system. But people are generally aware of what it is and how it generally works. So we have all the software that we need as well. And, you know, we have a 2-man team right now. So I think it's in a very good state, but we still have a long ways to go. And to have more of like kind of a tangible knowledge of our maturity, like we're working on our fields right now. So it's always kind of cute to talk about that. We've worked on our like colors and our buttons and, you know, more foundational things like icons, but we have yet to actually finish our like most basic text field. So with that being said, there's still a lot of work where people aren't able to leverage, you know, our components yet. And, you know, that creates difficulties that we have to like meet every day until we get to that point where we, you know, we have at least all of our fields, we have all of our modals and things like that. Cool. So I'm going to go over some inclusive design best practices from the design side, and then I'll hand it over to Daisy to talk about kind of the same thing, but on the dev side. So this is kind of really what I've learned just kind of through working at a couple of different companies with design systems, and also just, you know, reading things from different websites and WCAG and all that stuff. But I like to kind of break up my best practices between foundations and components. So foundations from like a design system definition is those are like your colors, your typography, your icons, basically the building blocks for all of your other components. So if you're making a text field, you're going to need color for the text. You're going to need the text size, and you're going to need the border and all that kind of stuff. So when we're talking about foundations, I like to really consider really just like the big things of like sizing and, you know, when you are talking about text, the size of your text, and then the colors, like the contrast and stuff like that. So the foundations, it's kind of intuitive from the sense of like, you want to obviously make sure it's big enough and has enough contrast, but it's mostly on like how it's used. So the idea up front is kind of easy to understand, but like the application of it can be a little bit harder. Your color palette is never going to just be accessible off the bat. It's how you use your color palette. If you have two different yellows that are very close to each other, like, you know, if you never use them together, then, you know, you're going to have an accessible palette. If you do use them together, they're not going to be accessible. So that's something that kind of requires a little bit more planning up front of when you're creating your text, when you're creating your colors and icons. You have to say, like, well, where am I going to use it? Can I use this really small icon if it's only going to be used in an area where it's not necessary to the design, or people don't necessarily need to see it to understand the context? Switching gears over to components, this one, again, a lot more tangible. And I like to, you know, this is, again, just for me right now where we are with our maturity, contrast, size, and focus. So when we are building something like a button, does the contrast of the button background with the text, you know, pass AA or even AAA? That's always easy kind of when you're building out your components. You're saying, okay, what is it on hover? What is it on default state? We'll talk about focus state a little bit more. What is it when it's disabled, which the contrast is not as important there, but it's good to know all that. And if you have, you know, dark mode, you want to combine all those colors and say, well, what does it look like in dark mode and what's the contrast there? So you can kind of plan that out when you're building your components. And before it gets to dev, you say, like, okay, is it contrast accessible? You know, not to beat a dead horse on size, but again, is the text too small, or is even the tap area on your buttons too small? Those are kind of easier and, again, more tangible to think about. Lastly, I always like to throw in focus. If any of your components are interactable, always think about, well, like, what is the focus state going to look like? Make sure that it's going to be keyboard navigable when it actually gets inside of the tool. So those things are always, you know, good to look think about. If it's just like an icon component that's never going to be focusable, you know, you obviously just throw it out there. Don't worry about it. If it's anything that's going to be interacted with either, you know, your finger, mouse, or whatever, you know, software you're using to put focus on it, you got to understand like what that experience is going to be all about. I am sure I miss things, but those are kind of the big ones I look for when I'm kind of designing my new buttons or my new icons and things like that. And yeah, I'll pass it over to Daisy to talk about it from the dev side.
Awesome. Thank you, Alex. So I don't know if Alex mentioned this, but our design system is called Saguaro. So even though our company is Trainwell, that's what our shirts are. It's the name of our design system. There's probably about 20 engineers at our company. Alex, how many designers would you say?
We have 5 designers.
Okay. And it's just Lex and myself on the design system squad. So we have to communicate all of these best practices for the whole PD&E team. So that's product design and engineering. So that's over 30 people that we have to try to communicate. And so documentation is so key. Also, what's really important is like not everybody's going to be an expert, and that's totally okay. So whenever I'm looking at best practices for developers, I'm making sure I'm documenting it somewhere, and I'm making sure that we announce that to the whole team so they know best practices as well. So some of the things that we've been looking at is the first one's going to be alt text. So I'm not going to go into my alt text field, knowing that y'all are going to have that amazing call. I think it's I don't even want to say next week if I'm wrong, but I will be like, hopefully I can attend. But alt text is so important. And so there's a lot of different considerations for alt text. You know, when I was first starting out, I thought it was just describing what the image looks like. However, there's a lot more moving pieces, such as, does this behave as a link? And if so, you want to, you know, put the destination of the link. And so this is something that we decided to create a decision tree about what alt text should be, and that is documented. So now we know whenever we are creating something for the marketing site, or our application, we know that with alt text or with the image, everything should have an alt text. That doesn't mean that every alt text is going to have content inside. You can have an empty alt text. The screen reader will just kind of skip over that. However, we made sure that we documented what alt text is needed and when. Again, because not everybody that's going to be working on the dev side or the engineering side are going to be accessibility experts. So some other common ones are buttons versus links. So something that we're really trying to communicate on our team is when to use a button and when to use a link, and making sure that you're using those semantic HTML or that semantic markup to explain the story. So for an example, any interactive element should not be coded as a div. If you're, you know, using HTML, you should really look at those semantic elements and making sure you're using the correct thing. So if on click, the user is going to get redirected, that's going to be a link. If on click, a pop-up is going to appear or a form is going to get submitted, that's going to be a button. And so it's very important that on our engineering team and even on our marketing side, that we are clear of like what elements are being used and making sure that we're not adding a lot more JavaScript and a lot more things by creating this clickable div that's going to behave like a button. It's not going to be correct. Also, it's important that you're coding those correctly because the screen reader user is able to navigate through all of the links, through all of the headers, through all of the buttons. And if those are not coded correctly, they might not know what's there. Some other things that we look at is, even though we want text associated with icon buttons, maybe there's a use case where we don't necessarily can put text with it. So making sure that there is a title or an ARIA label, something that's describing the purpose of that button or link. However, that's something on our team, we're making sure that there's text associated with every button and link. We also need to make sure that we're not saying the words button and link in our description, because that's going to be read out loud as well of the element for screen readers. We also have to look at, you know, I like to say different words, cancel versus close, are going to mean two different things in regards to buttons. So we have to make sure that it sounds correctly. So we do a lot of screen reader tests, a lot of manual testing for accessibility, and a lot of automated tests. Focus ring, that is something that, you know, Lex mentioned, but we need to make sure that our focus is when the user is keyboard, using a keyboard. Sometimes if you just add focus state, it might just show up on click, but you really need to make sure that if a user is using keyboard navigation, that they know where they are in their screen. So that's why I wanted to talk about focus. And so there's so much more that we document and we look, but those are some of the big things that we're looking at currently at Trinual and how we're communicating. So kind of because we're such a small team trying to communicate with all of product design and engineering, we're trying to focus on one new thing a day or a week. So this week WIG is, okay, let's work on focus state. Last week it was, let's look at alt text. And that's important because, you know, accessibility is a marathon and not a sprint. And if you just come out of the gate swinging, hoping to get everything accessible overnight, you're going to get exhausted. It's not feasible. And then trying to tell your team all of these new things is just going to get very daunting for them. And so we like to lay it out as one new thing a week, because I think it's more maintainable for the whole team.
And Daisy, if I can just jump in there, I think that's super important. And like, for the designers on the call, or people that are aware about design systems and how to build them out, like we look at it kind of the same way. So like, when you're just starting off with a design system, you don't want to make like a modal before you've created like your buttons and your colors and stuff like that. So when we're looking at this like one thing a week kind of thing, we're not trying to be super ambitious and tackle something that is going to have a lot of dependencies. We're taking something that makes sense at the time. So like, as much as we've wanted to get to like restyling our focus rings, maybe hasn't happened quite yet. We're still kind of working on buttons, but looking at other components that we're currently working on that would, you know, be super, you know, it would go a long way if we like tackled it at that moment. So picking your battles at the right time. The last thing, Daisy, before you can jump back in, is for these like best practices between design and dev, you can see there's definitely overlap. And I think, again, with where our maturity is, we're handling a lot of this, but especially the, like design leads, like designers always talk about how empathetic they are. So put them to the test on that. Like it's not rocket science to learn between what's the difference between a link and a button is, or even what the best practices of alt text is. And we all know that designs first start off with designers. So instead of throwing these designs over the wall, so to say, the dev and them making sure like what alt text to have, you know, upfront, maybe they should be defining the alt text, and maybe that's a little bit farther in your maturity process, but it's better to have, you know, a idea of the alt text and, you know, a developer to come in for approval or tweaking rather than just saying, I need alt text in all these areas, or even worse, not mentioning anything and just leaving it up to the developer. So.
Yeah, Bruce had a really good call out because I briefly talked about it, but I didn't go into a lot more depth. And there is so much more with accessibility. I know we're not going to cover everything about every way to use like a semantic markup or, you know, semantic HTML. But this one is a really good call out, and that's with headings. So that's going to be using an H1 through an H6. And so I know I'm guilty of this. When I first started off as engineering, I used those for styling purposes. H1 out of the box has really large text. H6 is really small. So when I was looking at a design, I'm like, oh, okay, this looks to be, you know, this amount of pixels. So I'm going to use the H3. And that's not correct. We should not be using H1 through H6s for styling purposes. They need to be in numerical order. They need to tell a story. So that H1 is going to be, you know, your title of your whole page. And then each subheader is going to be, you know, maybe an H2, maybe they have a subheader underneath that. There's a really great Chrome extension that I use called Headings Map. And so you can run it through your website on a page, and it'll show you the number order. And then it'll like alert you if you have more than one H1. You're not supposed to have more than one H1 on a page. It'll let you know if you're not going in descending order. So really, really, really good tool. You know, I highly recommend, if you are familiar with screen readers or maybe you're just starting off, go ahead and try to navigate your screen with just headings. They will put them in numerical order for the headings. And so again, you're as somebody using a screen reader, they might say, okay, heading one is the most important topic, but if we're not coding it correctly, it's not gonna be correct. And you also want to make sure you are using headings. Don't use divs, don't use spans. Like, you want to make sure that they can orient themselves on the screen. Landmarks as well. You want to make sure that they can skip through content. You know, when I use my screen reader, it's so annoying when I have to hear a whole page before I can get to a place that I'm, you know, looking for. I mean, we won't talk until a lot more landmarks, but these are some things that we look for on dev side. And Lex does a really good job on our design side of, like, you know, pointing these things out and making sure it's communicated across the team. Okay, so I'm going to talk briefly about testing at Trainual and how we test all of our components. So if you're not familiar with Storybook, that's where we are showcasing all of our components. And so these are going to be very foundational, such as just a link, and then we have just a button, and then we also kind of showcase the different states. So what does that button look on hover? What does that button look on focus? What does that button look for the different sizes? This is really important for our design team to be able to see all the options that we have, as well as engineering to know what kind of recipes they have that they can play around with, and then great for product as well. And so at Trainual, we use their other tool called Chromatic. And this is allowing us to test for visual regressions. This is really important for accessibility as well, because we are a large team of over 20 engineers. And even though I might change this color to be accessible, another squad might come in and say, oh no, I want this color to be different. Because we are quite a bit of squads, and it's hard to communicate with all of us on a weekly basis. And so Chromatic allows me to get notified if anybody does alter one of our design system components, and I can see exactly what that regression is. It's going to give you a difference of your actual image and not the DOM, which is very, very important if you're using a tool that maybe your class names will change each time the page loads. And so this is very important to make sure that we're staying on top of, once we put something accessible in place, that it stays that way, because color is a really big one and it's so hard. We need to make sure we're not using color to explain meaning and making sure there's a good color contrast. So we just want to ensure that other squad members, not saying that they would, and, you know, things happen over by accident. You know, we all know CSS. Cascading style sheets, you mess with one thing and something else like completely changes that you might not want. So it's definitely like our safety net. I definitely talked about, you know, I test with a screen reader. We're starting to train all of our QA team to also test with screen readers as well. It's an ongoing process. We're not perfect, but that's something that we're slowly getting into. And same with, you know, we use some automated tools, but we also manual test. So whenever we're creating a new feature, or maybe a component, we'll write out all the different types of manual tests we need to do. So buttons, you know, make sure that focus and hover state look different than, you know, just the normal state. So things like that. So we have our own kind of like testing checkbox. If you're looking for that, you can definitely search online. There's a lot of great checklists for manual testing. I don't have brand loyalty or test loyalty. You can ask Lex. I use so many different softwares because they all have something like that's going to benefit them. And so, but I think it's best for you to like test out what works best for your team. Communicate that because not every tool is going to be the same. So if you're testing with one tool and QA is testing with another tool, you might have some conflicting things because some tests might not test for everything. For an example, Lighthouse is used on our marketing site, but we use something else on the engineering. And so whenever I'm looking at our marketing site, marketing's like, well, nothing failed. I'm like, ah, but you know, this tool it does. And then with manual testing. So it's just important to stay consistent. And that's something you can document in your style guide or your design system as well, of like what testing tools you're using internally. Okay, I will switch it over to Alex.
Yeah, so for the last part of this, we'll kind of talk about just the buy-in side of things. So how do you get people to get engaged and jump on board for accessibility in within your company? So just an initial disclaimer, like I think the ideas that I'm going to bring up are probably good in theory at every company, but it's going to be like a different mix depending on the company. If you're working remote, if you're not, you know, it's just going to be different for every company. So take all these ideas with kind of a grain of salt, but also understand that like some form of this is probably a good idea. So the first thing I'd say is just definitely speak people's language. You know, if you're bringing up accessibility to someone from the finance team, like you don't need to say, you know, how much, you know, better the UX is going to be or anything like that. You know, that might be important. That person might understand that, but you know, you can also talk about how much money it's going to save, you know, in the long term and stuff like that. When you're talking to designers, obviously talk about how, you know, this isn't going to affect how pretty or how the user experience is not going to take an effect. And if anything, the user experience is going to increase. So the second part I'd say, or second idea is really to just promote and engage. So we have an accessibility Slack channel at our company. We're mostly remote. I know Daisy and I are fully remote. So having a Slack channel and posting, you know, new things about what other companies are doing or what we've done inside the channel is a great way to get people to engage. And also like on another side, like, you know, Daisy was just talking about the t-shirts earlier. Daisy and I are wearing Saguaro t-shirts for our company's design system name. So, you know, if people want a t-shirt or they ask like, what is that? It's a great way to start talking about accessibility at the company. So do whatever you can to promote and then engage, you know, people with accessibility and inclusive design. The final note I'll have on this, and probably the strongest argument from the design system perspective, is like, it's really easier to bake this in up front. I know Stark is like an accessibility tool for Figma, and they always talk about like baking in accessibility from the beginning. And it's going to be tremendously easier to do what Daisy and I are doing up front in V1 of the design system when we're building out these components than it would be for V2. And obviously that means the accessibility is going to come into your product earlier. So, you know, that argument might not always make sense in terms of like, you know, it's always better now than later, I'll say that, but it especially makes huge amount of sense to do it up front if you're starting from scratch, or, you know, you're moving from a legacy code base to a newer code base, or you're starting at a brand new company and they need a design system. It's been a privilege and like in just a huge increase in ease of use for Daisy and I to just kind of start from the beginning when we were building out our foundations. Some of the things that were kind of inside our tool before we had started with the company, like we're still tweaking right now because there's so many dependencies on them. So it's, you know, it's very easy to see the stuff that we created ourselves. It's been kind of accessible from the start, while the things that were there, you know, maybe even a year earlier, still aren't accessible because there's just so many dependencies and it becomes a spider web. That's kind of how all I had on that. Daisy, did you want to chime in and give more buy-in tips?
Yes. Let me just finish this one link. Sorry.
No worries.
Okay. Awesome. Okay. Yeah. So for buy-in, so definitely like agree with what like Alex stated. So it was really important that we found somebody in our corner to really help us advocate for accessibility. And so luckily for us, the VP of engineering actually wrote his dissertation on assistive technologies. And when he came to Trainual, he always wanted to make Trainual more accessible. However, Alex and I, we kind of, there's a saying like force something down someone's throat. And so we definitely were just like, hey, we're making this accessible. Hey, we're making this accessible. So definitely just do and not ask for permission. And because of that, there's another saying, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. We were definitely very squeaky. And so because of that, we're going to start training all of our engineering and QA on accessibility best practices starting at the end of at quarter three, which is a huge win, especially since it was not something that, it's not that the team didn't want to do it. It was just like, when do we prioritize this? That's the big thing. We're changing languages right now. We're implementing a brand new design system. So there's a lot of moving pieces. And so the fact that we were able to find someone in our corner to help advocate for that, and it being on the leadership team, like that was a huge win for us. So I definitely recommend just, you know, talking to people on your team. They might not know what accessibility is, but if you advocate and explain it to them, you know, how can you not get on board with making, you know, a website or an application more accessible? So that kind of ties into the education piece. So again, I mentioned that everybody is going to be an accessibility expert. And so just talking about it to people one-on-one, you know, they say, oh yeah, this is great. However, I'm just afraid. Or, you know, I've heard that the documentation is scary, or I just don't know where to start. And just allowing them to know that you're going to be in their corner to help explain. And so for us, we used our Trainual, which is our internal tool that we used our actual product. And that allowed me and Lex to make content depending on the different teams. So an example, we have a training manual, which is my Trainual, the name. We created a Trainual manual just for customer-facing roles. How should they talk to people that disclose that they might have a disability? What do you do if somebody asks for an accessibility feature? So we created this training content that whenever a customer-facing role, somebody switches to that role, or the new hire, they automatically get assigned this. And it's so important. And you know, we can end that session with quizzes, and we're making sure that people are consuming that information. So we're also doing the same thing for QA, engineer, design. We're making sure that everybody knows their piece of the puzzle. So, so with the education piece is also documenting. You can't just tell people, okay, this is how you make, you know, an alt text more accessible. You really want to document it somewhere, make sure that they have access to that documentation. Especially, you know, you might not touch alt text for several months and you might be like, oh, I forgot. Like, how do I do this? And so it's documented somewhere, you know, it's your single source of truth. So what we do is we just research, you know, the documentation for accessibility and really try to put it in more layman's terms. Provide a lot of code examples, a lot of design examples, just to make sure it's very clear. We also do a lot of lunch and learns. So this is when we get together, all of product design and engineering, for an hour every other week. And so people can sign up. And so we decided to create lunch and learns about accessibility. So part one to get buy-in was, why does accessibility matter? So we brought in the statistics of, you know, the 15% of people around the world have a disability. We also brought it down to, because you might get told, well, maybe our users are not disabled. So I bring in the piece that I have a disability, because it's a really shocker piece. Because just by looking, you know, I mean, I have a hidden disability is what it's called. Like, just by looking at me, you might not know. We also talk about the marketing piece, how if you increase your accessibility, SEO can also increase organically. And so we do, we know who's coming to this this meeting, and we want to make sure that we're advocating for every single team member and why that they should say, oh yeah, we really need to do this. We also talk about on the product side of, like, you know, if it's more accessible, then, you know, we can have more users. There's that Field of Dreams movie. If you build it, they will come. If you build it more accessible, you're going to have more users be able to use the product. So lunch and learns were very important. We created a lunch and learn a couple of weeks ago for just testing, why testing is important, and then how we test. It wasn't a, okay, now go home and go and test this, but it's just so it's on their mind of, okay, a lot goes into testing. And so we do a lot of, you know, information through Slack, you know, making sure that we, showcase some before and after of why it's so important. Focus state was a big one. I also record a screen reader. Maybe a lot of people at our company don't use them, but I'm like, listen to how a screen reader is going to read this. It's horrible. It's reading the path of the image. It says unlabeled image. I have no idea what this image means, but now that we've added alt text, now listen to this. Now you definitely understand. So it's very important that we constantly advocate. It's something that it's an ongoing process to try to get buy-in. And again, the ask for forgiveness, not permission. Lex and I decided that we're going to follow WCAG's requirements, even though we're going to try to do AAA whenever we can. But we decided that between ourselves. And then we just said, oh, hey, company, this is what we're doing. We didn't ask, can we make the site more accessible? Because product is probably going to say, well, why should we? And you might have a lot of questions. We just went ahead and did it anyways. So again, each team is going to be different. Each company is going to be different. You kind of know your company based on some of the things in the past. So, and it wasn't a lot of effort on us. And like I said, we already had a lot of these things in play, like using Slack for education. The lunch and learns were already in play. And so, but yes, each person in each company is going to be very different. So this is what worked for us. So please, like, don't do this and say, well, Daisy and Alec told me to do this and it just doesn't work. You definitely know, but these are things that worked for us.
And I'd even say, Daisy, the question asking your manager or anyone above you, like, you know, what standards should we follow, AA or AAA? I've never ended up getting an answer back. They always say, like, oh, like, you know, we'll get back to you. And, like, understandably, the kind of like the state that we're in right now, it's really hard for them to answer. I see kind of, you know, it might be very obvious to us and people on this call, but I see their side too of just like, you know, they don't want to commit to something. So I think that one's super important in terms of just kind of going with it and saying, like, well, we're just going to do it. And especially just bake it in the beginning. And it's really not too much extra work. And if it is, we just won't kind of tell them. But the last thing I'll say that you inspired me, Daisy, on kind of finding your allies too. We're talking about the VP of engineering. It's always a good one to get. It might not sound as poetic, and it's probably more practical, but like finding people who care, like I have found isn't really the easiest thing. It's like finding people at your company that like to learn and also who are like perfectionists. Yeah, I'm sure people know the perfectionists at the company and people that are willing to learn. Like, it is a lot to learn. So, you know, someone that might care might fall a little bit short. I think we found the most success on people that are, you know, really good developers or really good designers, people that are perfectionists and just want to do the best job that they can. And like, those people are going to know that accessibility is for the best. So.
So I had a question for May that said, any objections to aim for AAA? So no, that's something that we said whenever we can aim for like AAA, that's what we're going to do. There were some things that when looking at AAA and AA and just A, the conformance levels are going to be very different, but they're the standard or like the what you have to adhere to is very different as well. you're going to hear a lot of opinions. Some people say that AAA is not obtainable, and some people say that, you know, just A is like, you should never do it. I think that's going to be like an internal question of like what you want to do. So like we said, we're going to, you know, try to adhere to AAA whenever possible, but if not, then we're just saying that AA is our guideline, but knowing that we will look at AAA and try to hit that whenever.
And it's definitely never a no to AAA. It's just, again, with like the dependencies, it might just be like, well, we can't do it now. It'll be so much easier later kind of thing. So always on the back burner for sure. Looking at more of these questions.
Yeah. And I would say like, depending on who all you have to communicate with that, like, so, you know, we did have to talk to product about this is what we want to do and what level of conformance should we adhere to? And the first question was, well, how long is it going to take? Because I mean, you have to think of like revenue, you have to, and that's why it was so important for us to just have the huge meeting with the whole company and say, this is why it's important. Because you might have questions of like, how is it going to tie into revenue? And you want to make sure that you come to those meetings well prepared, because you don't want to sit there and stall and say, I don't know. Like, definitely, like, that's why we did the research of the accessibility and SEO. So what I did there, I ran a Lighthouse report, because you can run it on SEO and accessibility, and you could see where there's some overlap. I also made sure I, you know, got documentation that it was, you know, said that things that are more accessible have higher rankings for search engine optimization. So like, there are things out there that tell you that. So I just like to come prepared for any type of question, but even then, like, try to beat the question by just automatically saying, these are some of the benefits that we can provide. You know, one of the things is like, if you're trying to get your company to accept accessibility, let them know that it's not just people with disabilities this is helping, it's going to be usability. Maybe you have a user that's a brand new parent that's holding a baby in one hand and trying to navigate a computer with the other. There's going to be situational limitations such as that. Maybe they're in a library and want to watch a video, but you know, they forgot their headphones. How are they going to, you know, get that information? Include subtitles or at least a transcript. Maybe there's a temporary disability, broken glasses, or, you know, you broke your arm. These are things that you can advocate for or like push when advocating for accessibility, because it is that my last company, when I tried to push accessibility, I got told our users are not disabled, straight out flat. And so these are things that I just wasn't prepared for to have that response. So I did not know how to, you know, like counter that, you know, that, that comment. And so, you know, if you're trying to, you know, like I said, advocate it for your company, just be prepared to have a whole bunch of different questions. Cause it never fails. You're going to get asked a ton. Even our recruiter asked me a couple of days ago, well, like, why should we focus on this? I mean, it's going to affect people in the team that you don't really necessarily know it's going to affect, but yeah, that's, again, just really important. Like, do your research ahead of time.
That's an interesting, I'm trying to think of like a running list of things to prepare people for. So you mentioned just a flat answer of our users aren't disabled. I've definitely mm-hmm. heard from the design side, like, oh, it's not as pretty or something like that. I'm trying to think of other ones, like, you know, money comes up, extra time putting into it. It's complicated.
I get told, well, should we make a separate product that's just more accessible? Well, who wants to deal with two full websites, like carbon copies, except one's accessible, one's not? And then people say, well, we'll deal with it when we get asked to make it accessible. And you should just say, well, we could be losing people now. And as a matter of fact, like, we are getting people to reach out, luckily, saying, hey, where are you in accessibility and making this more accessible? And so this was just really helpful for me. So I reached out to, again, coming prepared, I reached out to our customer facing roles and said, hey, are we having people bring up accessibility? Are people asking if we're accessible whenever they're a prospect? So these were things that I just went ahead and asked to help prepare my case, my proposal. You want to make sure you're covering every base. And so, yeah, it's just very important.
I probably think too. Oh, sorry. Maybe are we at time?
I just thought I'd jump in. I think, I don't know if you have a lot more prepared, but there are a few questions that I noted down. So do you want me to hold a couple more minutes or?
No, please go.
Okay. So I know there's a little conversation in the chat, but just in case someone couldn't see the chat, I went to get this. It sounds like you all don't have a public decision tree on alt text that you mentioned, Daisy. It's not publicly available. Do you want to talk about the one you recommended? If someone's looking for one of those?
So currently our design system is not public. We're still a lot of work in progress. I mean, we just started this back in October. I think eventually we'll get some of it will be public. I could be misspeaking, Alex, but yeah. So I submitted in the chat one from w3.org, and it is in alt decision tree. This is not for every single use case, but this was a really a great starting point for the decision tree. So the first one is going to be like, you know, does the image contain text? And if no, then you continue to the next one. And if yes, then it's going to say, well, if it's, you know, associated with link with text nearby, then you don't add the alt text. So this is, you know, kind of how you use it. There's quite a bit of, like I said, use cases, but it's not the end all be all. I'm sure that next week's talk, they're going to talk about a lot more, and hopefully they can provide you with, you know, some other resources. But this was just the one that I saw. This is what I got the idea to make a decision tree internally. We just kind of, again, like rephrased a lot of the questions. We added a little bit more things like that. So.
Maybe even got rid of some things if like we just simply don't have that like scenario inside of our app.
So it's good to take these tools and modify it so it actually really applies to your organization.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's less useful. Do you have other design systems? So I know one that you mentioned, which we've spent a bunch of time looking at, is IBM's. Are you aware of other open source design systems, since yours isn't available yet, that you might recommend people look at if they're trying to get inspiration?
Oh yeah, we definitely have so many bookmarked. I'll let Alex share some of his favorite, but yes, IBM with Carbon, that's on our top list that we always look at. And that's a great point is, you know, if you don't know where to start, like take a look at those and you can see some of their documentation. Like Think Carbon has a great accessibility portion of like how to make this component accessible. I know they have their own like testing tool as well for like automated test. Can we link to Carbon? Yes. Okay. So, awesome. Thank you for linking that. Lex, do you want to talk about some of the other favorites?
I probably won't list any specifically. I'll put some in the chat, but the biggest thing is like some of them are definitely like low key, similar to our design system. It's like, you know, they might have like an accessibility section in their documentation, but they also might have it specific to each component. So like, it might be at like the bottom of like the buttons. They might have like 5 or 6 bullet points on accessibility. So I think IBM is like that too. So like, if you have your favorite open source design system in general, I'm guessing it has some accessibility stuff. And I can also put more links in terms of ones that like, maybe emphasize it a little bit more than others. But I definitely would say a lot of them will have some piece of it, and they just might be like a little bit hidden down at the bottom of the page.
Yeah, and like you're gonna probably find your own favorites. So some of the ones that we look for, we make sure documents like how to use the component, some of the best patterns, accessibility. We also look at examples like, do they have Storybook as well? Because that's, you know, a way that we can kind of look at how should we, you know, organize our storybook. So there's some really amazing ones. There's one called, is it Seeds or Sprout? I will put it in the link. There's two. I look at it a lot.
Okay. So Nick asked a question, and it's possible that you don't know the answer to this because it's a little bit WordPress specific, but they were wondering, he was wondering if you could share a little bit about the workflow of design systems to a digital product, which I know your product isn't specifically WordPress, but he was asking about a WordPress theme, but I don't know if there's things you can draw. He asked, how would you keep the WordPress theme files in sync with Storybrooke and your Figma toolkit? Do you have any thoughts about keeping code in sync with what you're doing or modifying in either of those places?
Yeah, so I don't have experience with WordPress, but what we do is whenever we're coding and creating the component, we immediately add the Storybrooke instance. So that lives with our code. So the moment we update the styles for that component in React and JavaScript, it'll automatically update Storybrooke. And then once we commit a pull request to get our code looked at, then Chromatic runs and says, oh, hey, there's a visual change. So so we do rely on a lot of like automation to get that to work. And so with the Figma side, that's where, so we use zero height, we called it Saguaro. And so that's where we can actually embed all like Figma and Storybrooke. And so that is, so zero height is our single source of truth. So it's going to have all the documentation about that component, all the different, you know, states. So hover and focus. And then they can see the Figma examples as well as the Storybrooke example all there. They don't have to worry about, you know, going to three different tools to find out how this works. It's just that one place they can see everything. Hopefully like that kind of made sense. Lex, you can probably talk about the Figma side because like y'all make components within Figma to try to make sure it's standardized between all of the designers.
I was busy with the, with the sending in links, but could you just quickly rephrase the question?
Yes. So whenever you're creating a new design, like you're using our palette system and type system, like you've already created foundational things inside Figma that makes it just easier for you to like, I guess, plug and play. So in that way, it's standardized across all of design of like, hey, these are how our buttons always look. So you've created a foundational component within Figma to do that, right?
Yes, exactly. So Figma is great with those foundational styles. I think some things that they're probably still even investigating in the future are probably things like spacing and like having padding and margin like variables, but they have color is great. You know, we always tell each designer, you never use a hex color. You're always grabbing from what we have in the tool belt, and you can make your text styles as well. You can make your icon components. So I'd say like icon, text, color, trying to think what other variables you can add in there. Other than that, they're still trying to bridge the gap a lot with development in terms of like, how can we again make it so that they're only choosing from the variables. In those senses, like for that practical example of like, there's no padding variable inside of Figma. What do? We you know, shove it down the designer's throats that like, you know, you're only supposed to be using the spacer variables that we have documented inside of our, you know, zero height documentation software. So that combined with using the styles is like the biggest thing that we're even, that was a big thing that even just this week was telling designers, like when you're making anything, you know, use only our colors, use only our border radiuses and things like that. So.
Yeah, I think we could definitely probably try and find a speaker to talk about how to do this in a more WordPress product thing. So I'll put that on my to-do list for people who are interested in that. We have just like a couple minutes. I'm trying to look back and see if there were any other questions. Let's see. So Beth had asked more about alt text, but I'm wondering if maybe it makes sense to save that for next time. And then I think mostly we've answered all of the questions, unless I missed any. So I think
if anybody like uses Medium, Alex does document a lot, like writes articles about our process, creating a design system. So some of it's what we've talked about today, but definitely take a look at Alex's like Medium articles, because there are a lot about design systems. I've seen in the chat where some people are wanting to start a design system. So yeah, that, you know, is a good resource. There's a book that both of us read about a design system. Again, I don't know how much WordPress is going to be different, but it's about design systems as a whole. So yeah, there's so many resources out there. Like, we've had to be very resourceful being just us two. But yeah, there's so much out there. We live in a great age where there's so much information for free on the internet. Yeah, so really awesome there.
So if anyone wants to follow up with you or get a hold of you, what's the best way to get a hold of each of you?
Yeah, so I definitely, probably LinkedIn and Twitter are my favorite too. So I am Dacey Nolan on LinkedIn. I think it is, Dacey-Nolan. I can share my link. And then in Twitter, I am Dacey_Nolan. So just my name. I'm not very creative. I like to tell people. But yes, I can also share my Twitter as well. I don't really post a lot as much as I used to. I do offer like free mentorship as well. If you like reach out to me and we're compatible, I offer free mentorships. So yeah.
For me, Alex? Yeah, LinkedIn is perfect. I just posted that in the thread as well, up there. So Alex Lackis on LinkedIn.
Great. Well, thank you both so much. This has been phenomenal.
Thanks for listening to Accessibility Craft. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe in your podcast app to get notified when future episodes release. You can find Accessibility Craft on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. And if building accessibility awareness is important to you, please consider rating Accessibility Craft 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Accessibility Craft is produced by Equalize Digital and hosted by Amber Hines, Chris Hines, and Steve Jones. Steve Jones composed our theme music. Learn how we help make thousands of WordPress websites more accessible at equalizedigital.com.